journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, August 26, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
The ACLU releases a new report on cops in schools. Adam Bradley joins us to discuss the poetics of hip-hop and is the economy growing or plunging? We'll try to answer that trillion-dollar question. But I can't help myself, why should I? This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Is the economy picking up or is it still plunging? Well, it depends on who you ask. In terms of long-term deficits, the White House Office of Management and Budget saw a rosier future, but the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, painted a gloomier picture. After heavy criticism, the White House revised its numbers to reflect a $9 trillion deficit over 10 years, as opposed to its original estimate of $7.1 trillion. The CBO did assess the potential effects of the $787 billion stimulus package passed in February, saying that economic activity will begin to rebound in the second half of 2009, largely the result of fiscal stimulus. Meanwhile, the Commerce Department reported that home sales increased nearly 10% in July, prompting some economists to claim that the housing market is bottoming out. On the employment front, one private survey showed that, quote, more than half of employers say they plan to hire full-time employees in the next 12 months, and 40% are expecting to hire contract, temporary, or project professionals. The survey also revealed that jobs in technology, customer service, and sales were expected to be among the first filled. My guest is Heather Boucher. She's a senior economist at the Center for American Progress. Welcome to Uprising, Heather.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
So first, the CBO and the White House both assessed the economy, as I mentioned, and they differed initially on the deficit numbers. The White House revised its estimates. What are the major differences between these two assessments?
Well, I think, you know, one of the major take-homes that I take from going over these over the past day or so is just how dire things look in terms of unemployment in both assessments. You know, we're seeing that the CBO is predicting that the unemployment rate is going to peak at 10.4% in the middle of 2010. That's in the middle of next year, and that it'll only come down to 9.1% in 2011. And OMB is also predicting that unemployment will remain above 8% at the end of 2011. So we are seeing in both of these documents that unemployment is expected to remain excruciatingly high for some time to come, and that needs to be our number one priority. If we don't get people back to work, this uptick we're seeing in housing certainly won't be able to last very long, as we're not going to see a lot of folks with the incomes that are going to support new home purchases.
And often unemployment as a measure of the economy is not considered the sort of first indicator. Stocks are, but it's jobs that matter most to ordinary people. Some have been talking about this already being a sort of jobless recovery. What do you think?
Well, I think it remains to be seen how soon the recovery actually happens. So I think I don't want to project whether or not it'll be a jobless recovery until we actually have a recovery. But having said that, I think that if we are predicting, if we're seeing that these government agencies are predicting relatively high unemployment through 2010 and through 2011, then that certainly means that we're not going to see the kinds of job gains that we need to in order to get everybody back to work. Now, you know, you just said that folks tend to not think of this as the first thing when they think about the economy, but we certainly should, because not only is this important for working families, which is the vast majority of us here in the United States, but it remains the case that consumers drive about 70% of our U.S. economy. If consumers are out of work or they're seeing falling wages because of high unemployment, That's going to drag down economic growth. So we need to remain very concerned about the unemployment data and the wage data to in our discussions about whether or not the economy is moving forward.
Much attention has been paid to the deficit as well, and the fiscal year 2009 deficit. It's predicted by both the White House OMB and the Congressional Budget Office to be just under $1.6 trillion. That's a pretty big record number. Should we worry about these deficit numbers?
Certainly, over the long term, the deficit is very important.
And do you believe the numbers of $9 trillion over 10 years?
Well, over 10 years. I mean, all of this is contingent on how well our economy performs in the short to medium term. Those deficit numbers have assumptions built in on how low unemployment gets, how strong wages are, because that affects tax revenues and government spending. So again, it comes back to how well we can get the economy performing in the short to medium term that that determines what those long-term deficits will be. And certainly, you know, as we're looking at very high deficits right now, we have to remember that the bulk of these deficits were caused by the failed economic policies of the Bush administration, not by the policies being enacted right now by President Obama to get the economy moving. That's been that's a relatively small share of the reason that the deficits are rising, but that we need to make sure that we keep our eyes on the prize. The goal has to be to get unemployment down, and that will, in turn, reduce our long-term deficits. So we need to keep spending now. We know that the fiscal stimulus is having an impact. It's helping to drive economic growth right now. It's really one of the prime things that's helping us move forward. So we need to make sure that we're concerned about this deficit problem in the long run, but in the short term, we have to focus on getting economic growth up and running.
And remind us what created the deficit in the Bush years.
Well, primarily, it was the massive tax cuts that we saw at the beginning of the Bush administration, which gave tax cuts primarily to the wealthiest American families. And at the time, the public was told that this would lead to strong investment, business investment, and economic growth. What we saw, actually, was the weakest growth of business investment in any economic recovery in the post-World War II period. Those tax cuts, which led to massive deficits that we saw at the end of the Bush term, remember he came in with a surplus, that those tax cuts did not, that not only did they add to the deficit, but they did not lead to business investment or the kind of job gains that we would like to have seen. So those were failed economic policies. We have all the data now to clearly show that, and they've left us with this significant problem right now when we can least afford it because we're in the middle of this great recession.
The New York Times' economist Paul Krugman blogged yesterday that on the issue of the deficits, he said it's bad, but it's not horrific either by historical or international standards. On a comparable basis, federal debt hit 109% of GDP at the end of World War II and hit a second peak of 49% at the end of the Reagan-Bush years. And a number of European countries have hit substantially higher debt levels without crisis. Heather, it seems as though the issue of the deficit becomes more of a political football, particularly one that the Republicans like to use rather than necessarily an economic one.
I think that is certainly true. I mean, again, we need to focus on what are we using the deficit for. The Bush deficits that were created, which are, again, still the majority of the deficit we've accumulated, were just primarily gave tax cuts to the very wealthiest Americans, but did not increase economic growth. They weren't a good investment. They weren't a good investment in our economy or our future. The deficits that we're accumulating now as a part of the recovery package are a good investment because they're helping to get our economy back on track. That's the rubric that we need to be evaluating the deficits through right now. And then once economic growth is humming along and once jobs are back, then pieces of the deficit problem will solve themselves because tax revenue will be up. We'll need to be spending less money to help low-income families and people hurt by the recession. And then we can deal with this very important problem. But the near-term problem really is unemployment and economic growth.
So let's talk about whether the economy has been stimulated or not. The CBO is looking at future growth just in the second half of 2009, which we're in already as a result of the stimulus package passed earlier this year. First, what do you think of that? And also, what do you make of the Cash for Clunkers program, which received a lot of attention recently, part of the federal stimulus package? Some have said that that program really did nothing to stimulate the economy. Others differ.
Well, I think that the economic recovery package certainly is having an impact on the economy. It's you know, Americans have seen their, most Americans have seen their paychecks get a little bit bigger because of the tax cuts that they've received. And we're seeing projects starting up around the country that are getting people back to work and are making the kinds of investment in infrastructure and in our communities that we so desperately need. So certainly it's having a positive effect. The Cash for Clunkers program is an interesting one. I mean, it serves two goals. I mean, on the one hand, it gets gas-guzzling vehicles off the road, and on the other hand, it's supporting the purchase of new automobiles. And to the extent that those new cars that are being bought are produced here in the United States, that certainly is helping to get folks here back to work and helping economic growth that way. The program, of course, is still relatively small relative to the demand. It appears that, but it also appears to be very popular. And it's not clear yet. I mean, we don't have good data on exactly how this is going to affect economic growth, but it seems unclear how there's any way that it couldn't, how it could not affect economic growth because it is spurring new car purchases.
And some have said that it has had a good psychological effect on the public. But let's talk about Ben Bernanke for a moment. Big news this week that the Federal Reserve Chairman was reappointed for a second term, and that has come under much criticism given that he was involved in creating the economic mess in the first place. What is your opinion on the Fed chair being reappointed?
Well, I think that there's a couple of issues. I mean, certainly number one, Ben Bernanke, in my opinion, did have a steady hand at the helm over the past year and a half as we've gone through this financial crisis, and has been very willing to take unusual and extraordinary steps to get the financial markets working again. And to that extent, he's been very successful, and I think we need to give him props for doing that, that he was willing to take those steps that were so extraordinary, the different ways of financing and the, you know, taking on these different debt burdens that really have gotten our economy back on track. So, you know, excellent on that. And you said that he was a part of the problem. I think that we need to be very clear that although he was a Bush appointee, he came late in Bush's term, and the real problems, the development of the housing bubble, the lack of regulation of the mortgage markets, these were problems that had been that were brewing long before he came to term. Granted, he did not move quickly enough to do something about it, but I would lay the blame for that on the Bush administration more generally and on Alan Greenspan, who allowed these problems to develop under his watch in the early 2000s.
Now, wasn't Bernanke right there with Greenspan in terms of agreeing with Greenspan's approach?
Well, certainly once he took the helm of the Federal Reserve, again, he was very willing to take these extraordinary steps to get the markets back in order. I think we would be in a far, I mean, certainly we would be in a far worse situation if we had had someone at the helm who had been unwilling to act in so quickly and so decisively to make more credit available to the financial markets. I think that the dire scenarios that we that many economists were discussing over the past year have not borne out at this time. And I think that we do have him to credit for some of that at least.
And how has, over the past several months, how has under Bernanke's leadership the power of the Federal Reserve increased? Some have said, well, that's not necessarily a good thing. The Federal Reserve has essentially just been creating money to pump into the system. Although inflation has not gotten high yet, perhaps it could in the future.
Well, again, I mean, when you're in the middle of a financial crisis as enormous as what we were facing last year, first and foremost, you have to get things moving again. If people can't borrow, then companies can't invest and they won't create jobs. Again, it all comes back to sort of the cycle of how the economy moves forward. His focus was on making sure that the credit markets worked so that companies could borrow and invest and keep our economy humming along. And I think to that goal, they have been successful in at least getting credit markets back to normal.
Well, let's briefly talk about the credit markets.
On the inflation point, though, I do want to touch on the inflation point. Right now, there's no evidence that we have an inflation problem, and there are two big facts staring us in the face. Number one, home prices are falling. They're falling rapidly, and even if they've hit bottom, they're still very low, and they're not going up anytime soon. along with this rental prices have fallen. That's a huge component of inflation that everyday people face. That's clearly not going to be a problem for any time in the near future. Second, we have very high unemployment. We know from decades and decades of research, high unemployment means lower real wages. High unemployment does not lead to inflation. So the two of the biggest things that actually would drive inflation aren't happening. So I don't think it is his focus on getting the economy moving, getting people back to work, and saying inflation is not the problem is clearly, clearly the correct path to be on. And we should be encouraging that kind of thinking at the Federal Reserve right now.
What about the issue of credit? I mean, credit may, how free is credit, and not just freely available in terms of businesses, but particularly, say, small businesses who really were hit hard by the crunch when the credit when there was a bit of a credit freeze, quite a bit of a credit freeze earlier in the year, and also to individuals?
Well, there have been a number of places where we've seen the credits markets come back. I think it's been slow, and I think that you've seen a lot of folks, you know, what's been happening is that institutions have been tightening their eligibility requirements. They're saying, yeah, you know, just because you have, you know, if you don't have a job, or if you're not earning enough, or if your business prospects aren't good enough, it's harder to get a loan now than it was a few years ago. And that's painful, but it also makes good economic sense. You know, one of the things that we saw in the mid-2000s was a lot of people being able to borrow money when it wasn't realistic that they would be able to pay it off, or there weren't realistic expectations mm-hmm. about home appreciation. So I think what we're seeing is a turning back. We're seeing financial institutions and banks being more cautious again, and I think that's the right approach. Again, in the short term, it's painful, and you know, I'm sorry for the families who now cannot afford the kind of, you know, get the mortgage for the kind of home that they would like to buy. But on the other hand, they're not going to get stuck in a home that they can't, they're less likely now to get stuck in a home that they can't afford than, on the same hand, a small business who may have been able to have an easier time getting a loan in the mid-2000s may have a harder time now, but they're not going to get stuck in a business model that may be untenable.
Well, what about housing? Do you think the housing market is bottoming out, even if prices haven't risen? The July numbers for sales show a brighter outlook.
Well, I was just arguing about that with our housing expert here, and I was very encouraged as I was looking at the housing numbers that came out today. You know, I'm a labor economist. I've been following this stuff very closely for, you know, a few years now, and it's been very grim. And I think this was the first time in quite some time where I actually smiled when I saw some economic news. Having said that, I don't think that we've seen a turnaround yet, but it does appear that things are close to or may have hit bottom. I was encouraged that the new home data shows a fall in inventory, primarily because that may mean that, you know, at some point over the next few months or, you know, 6 months to a year, that you will see construction companies hiring workers back to build new homes at some point in the future. And so that was certainly an encouraging sign.
So
it's not over yet, but it is encouraging.
Well, overall then, in the on the economy, Heather, looking at all of these things we've just been discussing, the assessments by the White House, the CBO, the housing numbers, and even some employment surveys. Well, I cited one employment survey at the top of the interview. What is your sort of overall assessment? Should people still sort of expect, if they are jobless now, to remain jobless for another year or so? Or are things perhaps maybe picking up?
I think that it appears that things are not getting worse nearly as quickly. I think for the labor market, which is fundamental to how we should be evaluating what's going on here, unemployment will still likely continue to rise. In the last employment report we had at the first of the month, at the beginning of the month, showed that the share of people who've been out of work and searching for a job for at least 6 months was at an all-time record high of a third. So it's very difficult for those folks who have been losing their jobs to get back into a new job. And I think until we've seen that number come down, until we see the unemployed who are out of work get back into the labor force, we won't have seen that's my definition of success. Having said that, I think I am cautiously optimistic that the pace of how bad things are getting in the labor market is, you know, we're seeing it slow a little bit. and hopefully we won't see any more sharp spikes in unemployment in the months to come.
So unemployment is the number one indicator that you trust in terms of the economy?
Well, I think that it is both one of the most important components for economic growth, because consumption, that is the dollars that you and I, consumers, spend every day, makes up 70% of our country's GDP. So the extent to which families are able to go out and buy those new cars and those new homes really does depend on their job prospects. So once we see the labor market coming back, we will know that we are certainly on the path to recovery. We're going to hear a lot about the stock market. We're going to hear a lot about whether or not the economic growth numbers turn positive in the months to come. But we'll know that we're on a strong path to recovery when we see the unemployment rate come down.
Heather Boucher, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Heather Boucher, a senior economist at the Center for American Progress, and we've been attempting to assess the state of the economy. This is Uprising, and by the way, you can listen to this and all our interviews. They will be archived online after 10 a.m. this morning, and previous interviews as well are all on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. Later in the hour, we will speak with a representative from the ACLU about a new report about the police presence in schools. We'll also, after today's Subversive Historian, tell you the question or play you a mystery speaker for our weekly contest, Who Said That? And following that, an interview with Adam Bradley on the poetics of hip hop. Stay tuned.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on August 26, 1919, labor organizer Fannie Sellens was brutally gunned down in West Pennsylvania. Dubbed the Angel of Mercy for her unionizing efforts, Sellens had successfully organized workers in Missouri and West Virginia. United Mine Workers of America leader Philip Murray, impressed by her dedication, offered her a position with the union. Sellens then moved to Pennsylvania to begin organizing in the western part of the state. Assigned to the Allegheny-Kiski Valley, the area had a dubious reputation for repressing unionizing efforts. Undeterred, Sellens was present that fateful night when the workers of the Allegheny Coal and Coke Company were confronted by company guards and deputies. In the ensuing violence, she was shot to death, as was a miner named Joseph Starzaleski. As has been all too historically the case with the criminal injustice system, no one was ever convicted of killing Fannie Sellens. The Angel of Mercy was shown none. For Uprising, this is your truth professor. Saying it's no mystery, why? They conceal our people's history.
And now we come to the special feature of our program.
Who said that? Who said that?
Who is it?
You got to tell me who.
So what do you call yourself, huh? Como se llama?
I can't hear you.
Who are you?
What's your name, dude?
Who the hell are you?
I really want to know.
If it's anybody, it's me.
Who?
Who?
So I've heard that before.
Before we go to our next story, it's time now for this week's edition of Who Said That? A weekly contest in collaboration with the Pacifica Radio Archives. Here's how it goes. We play you a short soundbite from the archives' vault and ask you to tell us who said that. To win the CD we're featuring, just call in and identify the voice. Let's take a listen to this week's mystery speaker.
Skippy said, shaking his head sadly at all the posturing that had been going on in that meeting, "I don't know about you, but I've been black my whole life."
If you know who that is, and if you haven't won yet, call us right now at 818-985-5735 with your best guess. That's 818-985-KPFK. Discussions of hip-hop and rap in the mainstream media often revolve around violent imagery, misogynist lyrics and videos, and a fascination with the dramatic lives of industry musicians. The art of the spoken word as expressed in hip-hop is often forgotten. But now a new book by Adam Bradley, professor of literature at Claremont McKenna College, examines in detail the artistry behind the music. Book of Rhymes, The Poetics of Hip-Hop, challenges the conventional conversation by appraising hip-hop lyrics as a revolutionary innovation in contemporary poetry. Book of Rhymes analyzes rap through its rhymes, similes, storytelling, and wordplay in constructing the argument that the genre has changed a generation's relationship to the spoken word. Dr. Cornel West has called Bradley's work a marvelous exploration into the poetic genius of rap and the cultural gravity of hip-hop. His analysis is subtle, sophisticated, and soulful. I spoke recently with Adam Bradley.
Hi, Sonali. How are you?
Doing very well. Thanks so much for joining us. So, as I said, the controversy over rap and hip-hop in the mainstream, it has been over several years now, that it glorifies violence and misogyny. And that is a conversation that always seems to come up every time there is a discussion about rap and hip-hop and seems to obscure the art. How significant is this argument and how much of it is grounded in legitimate concern?
You know, a couple of years ago, CNN did a special that they simply called Hip Hop Art or Poison, as if it's a simple choice between
art or poison,
a simple choice between one or the other. And, you know, I think in writing my book, what I found is that the lyrics demand a more complex understanding of rap. Often we understand rap lyrics as almost the cellophane wrapping around some kind of truth, some kind of greater truth, whether it be a truth about the images of young black and Latino and other Americans, or whether it be the truth about a particular political circumstance, or whether it be the truth about a particular kind of, almost a commercial vision of our culture. All of these things are there, but what we also have is a profound sense of a revolutionary poetry, a renaissance of the word, a return to rhythm, rhyme, and wordplay at their very best.
How do you analyze the rhythm and rhyme of rap? You know, even mainstream rap and mainstream rappers, very well-known artists have some pretty sort of genius lyrics. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, I mean, take somebody like Jay-Z, who is obviously a kind of a cultural icon who's transcended hip hop itself. He came out with his first album in the mid '90s, A Reasonable Doubt, and on that album he had a line like this, and it's really a simple sort of move, but he said something like this. Instead of saying that he was carrying a gun, because so much of his rhymes were about his life as a criminal. Instead of just saying, you know, I have a gun in my waistband, he would say something like this, like short sleeves, I bear arms. You know, that small sort of twist of wordplay expands it from being something that's prosaic and even potentially offensive to something that at least has a kernel, a spark of poetic energy and force.
Now, there is a long tradition, literary tradition, that in Western civilization, but also Eastern civilization, yeah, of the of poetry and of, you know, slam poetry, of people getting together in a community and exchanging you know, their works and their poetry. Can you talk about a little bit of that history and how it relates to how it has been combined, particularly by people of color here in the United States, into what is now seen as rap and hip hop?
Yeah, I mean, the nature of competition has always been at the center of poetry, whether you look in the Greek tradition of capping, or whether you go down to Argentina with the gauchos in the bars, you know, creating these ribald tales and rhyme. You know, these were things that are a part of an oral culture across all sorts of divides. And what we saw in the South Bronx in this period in the late 1970s was,
which is considered the birthplace of hip-hop.
Yeah, the birthplace of hip-hop was a group of young people who were looking for a voice, looking for a voice that was denied them by traditional forms. You know, KRS-One, whom you began this segment with, you know, has this wonderful line where he said, "Hip-hop is the final conclusion of a generation of creative people oppressed with the reality of lack." And I think that's just a poignant way of understanding how these young black and brown predominantly people created this language art that could give them inspiration and creativity even when everything seemed to be limiting those options for them.
Let me go back to the earlier question then about the themes of violence and particularly of misogyny that do cloud the discussions on hip-hop and rap. Isn't there something to be said for the extremely misogynist themes running through many lyrics that are just playing on mainstream radio?
Definitely. I mean, the misogyny, the homophobia, all of these elements that are part of hip hop and have long been a part of hip hop are, of course, also a part of our broader culture. Mm-hmm. And hip hop has always had, in addition to those darker elements, has always had a resistance to those very elements as well.
But they don't get played on the radio, generally.
Yeah, often not. And yet I think one of the silver linings, perhaps, of the economic downturn as far as it's affected radio and the record industry more broadly, is that in the downturn, and particularly its effect upon hip-hop, which is hit hardest of all popular musics, we're now looking for other places to find the music. We're going online. We're listening to clips on YouTube. We're listening to people with their music on MySpace. We're finding other venues of distributing the music. And in doing that, I think having the potential to hear other voices that might not be heard.
Now, in addition to the message, of course, the message is so important, but the art is the most important thing, right? I mean, the art is what people respond to.
Yeah, I mean, the rhythm, simple, something like that. I begin my book with a chapter on rhythm, and I talk about an experience I had down in Brazil on a beach and having these lyrics from Wu-Tang Clan coming to my mind and you know, having this moment where a 15-year-old kid who didn't speak English beyond those lyrics, and I didn't speak Portuguese, that we could have a connection through the rhythm alone.
So it's not just good enough to have conscious lyrics or a message, but you have to be a good rapper.
I think that's what it comes down to. Talib Kweli said that very thing. He said, you know what, it's great to have a message, but if you don't have flow, you don't have anything.
Now, what about the discussion then in the mainstream that tends to not give enough credence to the poetics of hip hop? And how much of it has changed over the years? You are in academia. There are people like Bakari Kitwana who've written about hip hop, and it is slowly becoming more and more. Michael Eric Dyson is slowly becoming more and more accepted, I think, in academia. Is that true? I mean, is academia accepting that hip hop is poetry? And of course, your own mentor, Cornel West.
Yeah, no doubt. I think in part, you know, it's impossible to resist hip hop within the context of a university and college setting, because we have a generation of kids who've known nothing but hip hop, who have not known a world in which hip hop didn't exist. And so for us as teachers responding to our students, that we need to be at least, if not conversant within the languages of hip hop, at least aware of it, conscious of it, and bringing it into the classroom in ways that are responsible, that are creative, that are imaginative. And that's what I think what I strive to do myself in my teaching of hip hop, in addition to writing about it.
What has the rhythm, the rhyme, the art coming from young people who have not had access to higher education, who have not studied Shakespeare necessarily or the major Western poets? What is the significance of this poetry coming seemingly from the grassroots, from urban centers, from poor communities?
I mean, it's a revolutionary thing. I think that hip-hop emerged as a rebel music. And in doing that, it connects to a broader Western poetic tradition that goes all the way back to Beowulf, goes back to Shakespeare, goes back even to the ballad stanza. And yet also within that is this, as you suggest, a sui generis form, something born of itself in as much as it both borrows from tradition but also creates a tradition of its own.
You talk in your book about something called a dual rhythmic relationship. Can you explain that concept?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is the synergy between voice and beat. You know, that is, hip-hop is born in its simplest form, not just with two turntables and a microphone, but even simpler with a tabletop that you can pound out a beat. And then the improvisation, the rhythm, the flow that the voice creates over that beat. You know, that kind of relationship protects both the frailty of the human voice when left alone and also protects from the monotony of the beat when left alone. it's really when beats and rhymes come together.
It's that interaction.
Yeah, that we have hip-hop, that hip-hop is born.
And how much, so we talked about the poetics of hip-hop, but also let's talk about the music of hip-hop. Mm. How much of the music of hip-hop that interacts with this poetry to create hip-hop is also born from long traditions? I mean, you know, certainly it has been influenced by African traditions, by Latin American traditions. Where does, you know, draw that line, trace that for us?
I mean, hip hop emerges out of the sample, out of the earliest rap song, of course, that played on mainstream radio was Rapper's Delight. And it came from almost directly a replay of Good Times by the disco band Chic. So that moment in which hip hop makes its public emergence suggests what's to come. Hip hop emerges out of a Caribbean tradition, out of a Western musical tradition, out of all of these hosts and combinations and recombinations of musical forms. So as we're having this kind of self-referentiality and other kinds of wide ranging ideas emerging in the lyrics, we're also seeing a similar kind of, gumbo going on the level of the music itself.
Are you concerned about co-optation?
You always have to fear that. You have to fear the banalization of culture. And those of us from minority communities are always on guard against this. And yet the natural state of culture is one of freedom. This is something that we see in the way that hip hop is becoming a global phenomenon in which people from Bangladesh to Bangalore to Bangor, Maine are finding ways of making it something that's distinctly their own.
My guest is Adam Bradley. He has written The Book of Rhymes, The Poetics of Hip Hop. He's also an assistant professor of literature at Claremont McKenna College. And Adam, let's talk about the future of hip hop. I mean, there's often, the death of hip hop has been pronounced several times over the past several years. What do you make of that? And who do you see as the future of American hip hop in particular?
I mean, it's a good question, and it's important that you put that distinction on American hip-hop, mm-hmm. because before I was going to take the easy road and answer that the future of hip-hop is outside of these borders.
Right, right.
And yet when we think about a domestic hip-hop form, I think it's going to have to be born out of maybe the death of commercial hip-hop radio. It's going to have to be born out of young people finding their voices in the same ways that those revolutionary voices emerged in the late 70s.
Now, well, wouldn't the death of commercial hip-hop radio also signal the deaths of many high-powered careers in hip-hop itself?
It has to. I mean, but that's the thing. I mean, instead of a young kid looking at the model of someone like 50 Cent and saying, I want to become this corporate entity, maybe there'll be something good, again, in the words of KRS-One, when rappers have to have day jobs, when the people who are doing it have to actually have so much love for it that it's not going to be their meal ticket necessarily. It may be just a matter of their art, their craft, their passion.
But shouldn't artists have, their vocations be respected enough to be able to earn a living from it?
Of course. And believe me, as someone who studies the work of great artists throughout the centuries, as someone who fancies himself at least in part an artist, that's something that we all strive for. And ultimately, that's what we need to do is reassess the values of our culture to put artists where they belong. And I think creators of hip hop can be on the cutting edge of this by returning us to the word, returning us to the rhythm, the rhyme, the wordplay.
And there's also, of course, the whole conversation around commercialism that we don't have time to get into. But I want to focus very briefly back to one aspect of your book, Book of Rhymes, The Poetics of Hip Hop, where you talk about the storytelling aspect of hip hop. How important is storytelling in hip hop, and how prevalent is it? And is it generally focused on one's own story? Or is it the story of a community or story of somebody else?
You know, it's all of those things. This storytelling is central to African-American traditions, oral traditions more broadly, often because in order to assert a story that was counter to the dominant one, you had to find that voice. What we hear in hip hop often is, you're right, the first person, the I, speaking most often his, but also her stories. The level of complexity that I try to add in my book is to say, you know what, sometimes these eyes aren't necessarily simply the voice of the rapper, him or herself, but are in fact personas that are being put on, that are being tried on. So, for instance, with Jay-Z, you have Jay-Z, but you also have Jigga Man. With Eminem, you have Eminem, Marshall Mathers, Slim Shady, all these different personas that these artists are putting on. And in that, we give them the credit that they're due as artists who in having the capacity to have multiple voices.
Having studied hip-hop and, you know, written this book and analyzed it, what words of advice would you give young aspiring hip-hoppers, not just necessarily people looking to make it an art as their livelihood, but just people looking, young people looking to express themselves? What's the best advice you can give them on how to best hone their craft?
You know, I think that's it, is to think about hip hop as a craft. Often we think about all the trappings of it. What clothes should you wear? You know, what sort of fitted hat should you wear? What angle should you cock it? But yet, when you look at the artists who are actually achieving great things, they work hard. They write in their book of rhymes, the title from which I derive my own title, this idea of a place where you work on your craft, where you work on language, where you learn vocabulary, where you revise. You know, all of these things are what will make you a success.
Adam Bradley is a professor of literature at Claremont McKenna College. We've been talking about his new book called Book of Rhymes, The Poetics of Hip Hop. Before we go to our next story, just want to announce that nobody guessed the correct answer for this week's Who Said That, which is a surprise since I actually gave you the person's name. He said his own name in the clip that we played. I'm going to play it again. Listen carefully. If you guess the correct answer, call us at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Here is our mystery speaker once more.
Skippy said, shaking his head sadly at all the posturing that had been going on in that meeting, "I don't know about you, but I've been black my whole life."
And if you can guess who that is, call us again, 818-985-KPFK. Also, very briefly, before we go to our last story, for those of you who won tickets to see Lila Downs or were planning to go on your own to see her at the Grove tonight, we played an interview with her on Monday. That show at the Grove has been canceled because Lila Downs came down with appendicitis. So she has canceled all her LA events, but the Grove event has been rescheduled for October 25th, and all tickets will be honored, including the tickets that we gave away on the show. So don't go to the Grove tonight if you were planning on seeing Lila Downs. She's been rescheduled for October 25th. You can also check out her website to reconfirm that. In February of 2005, Bronx school principal Michael Sogero was arrested for trying to prevent a police officer from arresting a student that he thought should be disciplined by the school. Throughout the U.S., city police are dispatched to public schools in response to reports of violence quite regularly, but this form of policing brings with it serious questions, including which student acts merit criminal charges. A white paper released yesterday by the Racial Justice Program of the American Civil Liberties Union examines the perils of school policing and argues that new guidelines are needed to ensure that policing creates a safer school environment. The authors contend that when officers' roles, students' rights, and school policy are not explicitly outlined, students, teachers, administrators, and the justice system may suffer. The report also cites the negative impact of in-school arrests on the students and the school community, and show how students of color and students with disabilities are disproportionately represented among those arrested or referred to court. Additionally, the report demands strict accountability and transparency, special officer training, and recommends expanding non-punitive approaches. My guest is Catherine Kim. She's the co-author of the report Policing in Schools and a staff attorney with the ACLU's Racial Justice Program. Welcome to Uprising, Catherine.
Thank you, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how common is it for those who aren't as familiar with the public school system, may not have kids going there regularly, how common is it for police to be dispatched to schools around the country?
You know, unfortunately, there's very, very little reporting and accountability for these programs. So there aren't any precise figures, which is, we posit, one of the major problems. But, you know, one study showed, for example, that 60% of high school teachers in the United States report having armed police officers stationed at their school. In Los Angeles specifically, for example, LAUSD, it employs its own police force, and every single high school and every single middle school in the district has an officer assigned to it.
And are these officers employed by the school, or are they city police that are trained to serve in schools?
You know, it varies by jurisdiction. In Los Angeles, they actually have their own Los Angeles School Police Department. in New York City schools, by contrast, they contract with the New York City Police Department, the NYPD, to patrol their school hallways. Our position is, you know, regardless of the actual structure, we see a lot of problems. Because when districts decide to deploy police to their schools, unfortunately, neither the school officials nor the police have really considered the impact that this deployment might have on youth, especially at-risk youth.
So why are students of color and students with disabilities disproportionately targeted? And in fact, what are those numbers?
You know, again, one of the goals of the white paper is to ensure sufficient transparency and accountability. We really don't have those numbers, at least not on the scale that would be really beneficial.
So how do we know that those students are targeted?
Well, we have found, for example, in specific jurisdictions where we have submitted public records requests. For example, we conducted a study, the ACLU conducted a study of school-based arrests in three towns in Connecticut and found that, in fact, students of color are far more likely to be arrested than the white counterparts for the exact same infractions. Likewise, you can draw from suspension data where there is national data available, which shows that students of color are 2 to 3 times more likely to be suspended than their white counterparts. And to the extent that these school resource officers, these police officers deployed to patrol the K-12 hallways as their regular beat, we have every reason to think that those kinds of disparities will play out there as well.
And students with disabilities?
And students with disabilities, again, the studies, at least for suspension, show that students with disabilities are far more likely to be suspended than non-disabled counterparts. But again, you know, you can extrapolate from that data, but given the absolute dearth of data on school-based arrests, we really can't say for sure exactly what the scope of the problem is. And that's really one of the main goals of the white paper, to ensure transparency and accountability. Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that public funds that are expended in this programs are actually improving safety rather than creating a negative school climate that may inadvertently push at-risk children, including children of color and children with disabilities, out of the school.
What effect does an arrest of a student in the school have, not only on the student, but those who are in part of that student's friend circle or in the same class?
Sure. And I would actually argue it has a devastating impact on the child who's arrested. Obviously, I think that when you hear about, for example, we had in New York City a 4-year-old boy who was handcuffed because he wouldn't take a nap, or a 13-year-old
handcuffed because he wouldn't take a nap?
That's correct. Or a 13-year-old boy in Florida was arrested for passing gas repeatedly. 14-year-old girl in Milwaukee was arrested for text messaging. And in Los Angeles itself, we had the teenager a couple years back arrested for dropping a piece of birthday cake. So if you can just put yourself in this child's shoes, you know, you can think of what a traumatic effect that has to be hauled out of school in handcuffs, taken down to the precinct and cuffed and have a record. But
does it have effects on dropout rates?
Absolutely. The national studies on juvenile arrest in general, for example, show that it reduces academic achievement, certainly. But if a student is arrested at school and it's coupled with court appearance, that child is 4 times more likely to drop out, 4 times. And a lot of studies likewise show that being arrested as a child drastically increases your likelihood of later criminal involvement. It's almost as though if you're in school and the authorities are already stamping you as a criminal, it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And then administrators are also, and principals and teachers can be at risk of getting arrested themselves if they sort of disagree with why their student is being arrested.
Well, this is one of the needs for one of the recommendations of the white paper. There really has to be clear lines of authorities. Under what circumstance is the school resource officer going to have final say? And under what circumstance is the principal going to have final say? As you mentioned, we've had incidents in New York City here in which the principal was arrested for obstruction of justice because he thought that the child who was being disruptive in class should be suspended, not arrested. The school resource officer disagreed and not only arrested the child, but actually arrested the principal as well. We had another incident, for example, in which the child was being disorderly, and the school resource officer wanted to arrest the child. Not only arrest the child, but actually parade the child through the hallways while classes were getting out to basically do a perp walk. And the principal interceded and said, this is going to be too disruptive for my school. I don't want all of my students in my school to be seeing this girl being paraded in handcuffs. I'd like for you to use the side door rather than the front door to avoid that. As a result of that, the principal was arrested. So when you don't have clear lines of authority determining when is it the police's final say versus when does a principal maintain control of his or her own school building, that's when problems arise. And go ahead.
Catherine Kim is my guest. She's co-author of the report, Policing in Schools. She's also a staff attorney with the ACLU's Racial Justice Program. Catherine, maybe it's because I'm an immigrant to this country, but just looking at this, it just seems like the hallmark of a barbaric society to have police be in our schools.
Absolutely. And we see this.
Am I exaggerating here?
Well, we see this as a larger phenomenon, which we call the school to prison pipeline, which are these emerging policies and practices that serve to funnel children, especially at risk children, out of the classroom and into the juvenile and criminal justice system. So it really is trying to get at the root of the problem, which we see as criminalizing children, treating them as criminals in their own schools. And so what we see, the purpose of the white paper, the reason why it was developed, is because we saw a real need for specific policy recommendations that districts and police should consider to make sure that the officers who are deployed there are actually improving the education opportunities for children rather than over-criminalizing them and pushing them out of school.
But why have police in schools at all?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. And this is a position, and that the white paper does not take a position on that specific issue.
Why not?
Well, in the olden days, there was some merit to the idea of, in prior generations, officer-friendly. To have, you know, a law enforcement officer there to really sort of serve as a positive role model for children. Unfortunately, that model has not been followed. And so instead, we have police who, you know, haven't come to an agreement as to when does a pushing match constitute a crime of assault that should be lead to arrest? When does talking back to a teacher or yelling in the hallway constitute the crime of disturbance of schools? You know, an absence.
But are these really crimes or are they infractions? Are they, you know, issues of discipline? I mean, how can you call pushing a child or talking back to a teacher a crime? How can it even be classified as a crime?
Well, you know, that's a really great point you make, Sonali, because in fact, one of the biggest critics of these kinds of programs, of these kinds of school-based arrests, are coming from the juvenile and family court judges. We had one family court judge, for example, tell us at the ACLU that he handles more school minor discipline infractions in his courtroom today than in his last job as a public school principal.
Hmm.
You know, and this is just clogging the juvenile court dockets.
Well, look, Catherine, your report has a lot of recommendations in it. We just have about less than a minute left. If you could just outline what you think are the most important recommendations that need to happen, and then certainly listeners can check out the entire report.
Sure. I think that we need to make sure that the school resource officer programs are held to rigorous accountability standards to ensure they're actually benefiting the children they're intended to serve. I think it needs to make clear distinctions between what are criminal offenses to be handled by police versus what are minor school discipline incidents that should be handled by principals.
And is there a website where listeners can get a hold of the report?
The white paper is available at www.aclu.org/racial justice.
That's aclu.org/racial justice. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough time to get into the details of the recommendations, but definitely you can check it out online. We'll also link it from our website at kpfk.org/uprising later today. Catherine Kim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
Catherine Kim is co-author of the report, Policing in Schools, and staff attorney with the ACLU's Racial Justice Program. And before we go to our subversive thought for the day, I want to announce the winner of this week's Who Said That contest, Maria Cornejo. Congratulations, Maria, for guessing the correct answer, which is Henry Louis Gates, a.k.a. Skip Gates. A little bit of background. Henry Louis Gates, Jr., often referred to as the nation's most famous black scholar, is a literary critic, educator, scholar, writer, editor, and public intellectual. He was the first African-American to receive the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation Fellowship. He hosted the 2006 and 2008 PBS television miniseries African-American Lives. He's now a professor at Harvard University, where he's also the director of the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African-American Research. Most recently, of course, he became the center of a national controversy on race when he was arrested by a white Cambridge police officer while trying to enter his own home. We will send a copy of the CD featuring a keynote speech by Henry Louis Gates, recorded in April 1997, to our winner. And we will also certainly recommend that you can get a hold of the CD by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's the Pacifica Radio Archives' phone number. That's 1-800-735-0230. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I want to quote Gandhi, who once said, "I object to violence because when it appears to do good, the good is only temporary. The evil it does is permanent." That's Gandhi, and that's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Natalie Yar is our intern. Melissa Figueroa is our engineer and director today. You can hear an audio stream of this show after 10 a.m. at our website, kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kulhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8. I